You got it.
Okay. Hi. okay, I have to kind of get over that, you know, Mr. Holland moment, which, like, I'm already at the end of the movie here, so I'm going to try not to cry. We flew in Thursday night, and it's just been amazing how, in some ways, obviously, time doesn't stand still, but how mercifully time does stand still in the sense that, you know, the have to talk louder. Oh, okay. I'm not used to microphones. Sorry. Okay. That, you know, friends that we've literally had friends and colleagues and former students who are now adults of their own and for 30 years. And it's just, it's a bracha. And I really, really, really appreciate it. And Lynn sells herself very short because she may have benefited from my brain, but I benefited a lot from hers, not to mention her very close attention to detail and pedagogy and curriculum development. And so I can tell you that from what I hear from my students' friends, the Academy students love her. So you're lucky to have her. Okay, I'm actually going to do probably the exact opposite of what I should be doing as a teacher, which is I'm going to stand up here and talk. And the only reason that I'm going to do that is that this is the forum for it, and I have 35, 40 minutes to kind of just, I guess, give over thoughts that I hope that you will take with you. Try to speak into the microphone. Is that better? Much better. Okay. All right. And as usual, I probably have way more on this outline than I'm actually going to get to. So I apologize in advance, and please feel free to email me, call me, and I can talk ad nauseum about this topic. And God willing, at some point in the next few years, I might actually write this all down. Since I was 16 years old, Pirkei Avot has probably been my favoritist, as I used to say, my favorite sefer, in the entire corpus of what I would call Torah learning with a capital T. And the reason that Pirkei Avot is my favorite is that it is the most diverse, it is the one that really reflects 400 years of Jewish people and Jewish thinking and Jewish learning, and even though it was finished about 1,800 years ago, it's in some ways one of the more timely and relevant Svarim that we have in our corpus of what we call, or what I call, Torah with a capital T. And every time I go back to it and every time I look at it again, I come away with something new. My approach to learning in general and my approach to Pirkei Avot is that I look at the language very carefully. Hebrew, as my students know, is a very vocabulary poor language and therefore a very connotatively rich language. It's in many ways the opposite of English, in that English has lots and lots and lots of words, each one having a very, very, very specific meaning, and therefore the allusions that are embedded in the language are much more culturally based, which is why when we read something like Shakespeare or Byron, it's so bizarre to us because we don't live there. We don't live with them, so the words that they use don't mean the same thing to us as it does to them. And similarly, you know, when my daughter says, "Oh, wow, that's really sick," that doesn't mean it's ill. It means it's amazing, right? I every single year I have to learn new vocabulary, including what I can no longer say, because, like, you don't hook up with somebody at the mall. That's not something you do anymore. Okay. But my students forgive me because they understand from their parents that their parents sometimes wear thongs in the summer, which means flip-flops, and they hook up with their friends in the mall, which does not mean what you think it means. So, you know, our language is very, very contextual. The Torah's language, Hebrew, particularly Hebrew that didn't evolve as much until the 20th century, is extremely connotative because every single word in the Torah has, like, these tendrils and branches and roots that connect to the same word somewhere else. So, for example, if I say the word or, and Rashi plays off of this in Vayihi Or, and he says, what is or? Or is Torah, or is Emunah, or is, you know, and this is this or is ganuz, is hidden for tzaddikim, for the righteous, because anybody who knows the word or, and you know, Rashi, even though we, for some reason, teach Rashi in second grade, Rashi assumes that we know the entire Torah by heart, not to mention the Midrash and the Gemara, that's all. So when he assumes, and we look at the word, vayihi or, that we know that entire, you know, concordance list of what or means. And that's how the Chachamim wrote. We have, and I actually just realized, learned this a couple of weeks ago, and so I love being a teacher because I'm always learning, is that the assumption that there was universal literacy was not actually true. In other words, everybody could read, even in the time of the Tana'im and Amora'im, but the idea of scholarship, the idea of really understanding the homiletics and the Perushim and the Midrashim and da-da-da, was a much more select group, and then, you know, the more specific you got, the fewer there were, and Rabbi Menachem Liebtag is very well known for saying that the average fifth grader in the United States knows way more than most adults knew in the time of the Tana'im, with the exception of the Tana'im themselves. And if you think about the fact that there were maybe in any one generation 200 of those Chachamim, that's a really, really small amount, right? If you think the fact that the composite knowledge of Judaism was in the hands of 200 people in Eretz Yisrael and then like maybe another 200 people in Bavel for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, that's not a lot. Therefore, the words that did get written down have to be looked at very, very carefully. And because, blessedly, miraculously, Hebrew is now a spoken language again, we don't really stop to think about what do these words actually mean. So that's, just so you know, that's where I'm coming from. And that's why you have the text in front of you. The text, the translation, I think, is from Chabad.org. Might not necessarily match up with the text, with the translation that I'm providing for you, but this is, you know, that was the simplest thing to copy and paste. So I'm going to go through a few of the Mishnayot in Perek Aleph of Pirkei Avot and highlight through the language how Pirkei Avot really reflects very, very contemporary values of teaching, learning, parenting, psychology, education, that whole corpus of stuff that we typically put into the category of chinuch, which I could give like a 15-minute talk just on what the word chinuch means, but I won't. So we're gonna just jump in and begin. So the very first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot talks about the Misorah, right? This is the Mishnah that kids typically memorize, right? Moshe kibel Torah mitzinai, umasruha leYoshua, etc., 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 etc. And again, we just like rattle this off, and we don't even stop to think about what do these words mean. So I want to go into depth into a few of the words in this Mishnah, and extract from the words themselves what they're teaching us. So first of all, Moshe Kibel, right, in the sense that that thing was, it was received. It was like he got it. And what's interesting is that Moshe is the only one who Kibel, in the sense that he didn't Oseh, he didn't make it, he didn't kona, he didn't acquire it, we're going to get there. You know, he didn't, the verb that is chosen is that he, who, kibel. It's like Hashem, right, Hashem gave us a present, but that's really what happened. It's like, he got it. He received it. He received this set of Encyclopedia Judaica, or Wikipedia, or whatever you want to call it, but this was something that was received, and it was received purely. So that's our starting point, that the foundation of what we live by is something that was received from a divine source. So the roots, the deepest roots of our Torah go back to God, go back to Hashem. And if we, that is like in those words, Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai, those four words, I believe if we constantly keep that in mind and let that concept guide the way we teach, the way we learn, the way we live our lives, then effectively we live, sorry to use the 21st century jargon, but we live mindful lives, right? We live mindful, holy, dedicated lives because we realize that we are literally rooted in Hashem. That's where we come from. So that's step one. And then that Hashem has given this over to us. And that given this over to us, and Moshe giving it over and giving it over and giving it over, is the second key element of teaching, of learning, of living, which is that this Torah is not static. As opposed to in other religions, where the canon or the dogma or the doctrine or the catechism or whatever you want to call it is something that is completely static. Judaism, interestingly, is the one major world religion that is constantly evolving in its understanding of text, in its conception of law, and in a way, the thing that makes Judaism the most challenging, and in terms of creating unity, is also the thing that has enabled it to survive, right? So there really is no one right way. That's what happens when there's a Mesorah, right? It's given over. And since I'm an individual, and each one of you in this room is an individual, the way what I do with the Torah and what each one of you are going to do with the Torah is as individuated, another 21st century word, individuated as each one of us. And this individuation is in there from the get-go. It's Moshe handed it over to Yehoshua, but then right away, Yehoshua handed it over to the Zekinim. There were many of those. And then the Zekinim handed it over to the Nevi'im, and there were even more of those. And then they handed it over to the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, and there were 120 of those. And we know what happens when you tell one piece of information to 12 people, much less 120 people. It gets diversified. And often we, you know, our students, and I know that Lynn has shared this experience, like, but what's the right answer, Mrs. Herzog? What do I write down for the test? You know, the test is 3,000 years of history, and the test is in that there is no one right answer. Which again is like totally counterintuitive with how we typically think of Western education and learning. There is no one right answer, which is, I think, often why higher level day school students have actually a harder time with the SATs, and I don't know if Mrs. Levin can corroborate this or not, because we tend to overthink things. We tend to read between the lines, because this is what our education has taught us. Right? Does this word mean this, or does this word really mean that? And on the other hand, that's why anytime you see a never or an always, just disregard it because it's automatically wrong, because there is no never and always. Anyway, the second word in that Mishnah that I would like to pay a little bit of attention to is this concept of Mesorah. Again, it's another one of these words that we use as part of our language, our lexicon, Mesorah. And we don't think about what a Mesorah is. So the word limsor actually means two different things. One thing means to hand over, right? Mosrim. But the other and much more common Tanakh and Tanaitic usage of the word limsor, that shoresh, mem samach resh, is in the context of restrictions. Moserot, which is used in Yirmiyahu, are reins. They're the reins that you use to guide an animal with the plow. Yisurim, the word that we think of as punishment or as certainly some kind of inflicted pain for some kind of a purpose, that's the same shoresh, right? Mosrim oto is used in the Mishnah. We chastise him. And if we stop to think about all of those words, we have to ask ourselves, how do they all fit together, Right? How does the concept of lovingly handing something over to someone, right? Shema b'ni musar avicha, which probably actually doesn't mean the tradition of your father. It probably means the reprimands of your father. But in any case, right? Shema b'ni musar avicha, we associate this word musar with morality, with mesorah, with a deeper message. Really what it is this. And if we stop now and we fast forward into 20th and 21st century psychology and we think about what is effective parenting, what we've learned is that effective parenting is what's called authoritative parenting. And effective teaching is what's called authoritative teaching. What does that mean? It means that there are rules. There are rules and there are consequences for violating those rules. Many of those consequences are actually natural consequences, right? If you don't study, then you will likely not perform at the level that you want to perform at. If you break curfew, then there will be a consequence like being grounded, right? These don't think of them in terms of punishments, but they're just consequences. But really what they are is it's a way of guiding children and students, and we're all children, we might be adult children, and we're all students, right? That's what law does. Law guides us. That law that says you can only drive X number of miles an hour in this particular district, well, maybe I don't want to just drive 25 miles an hour, right? But the law is restraining us, and the law might even punish us by giving that really annoying moving violation, and then you have to go to court and fight the ticket and da-da-da. But basically what it's doing is it's restraining us, and it's teaching us two very important lessons. Lesson number one is it's not all about me. Shocking. It's not all about me. And number two, that sometimes I need to restrain what I want for the good, for my own good, and for the good of society. Because I might not want to drive 25 miles an hour in a school zone, but I bet you're going to want that other driver to be driving 25 miles an hour when your child or grandchild is crossing the street in that school zone. And this is what reins, R-E-I-N-S, are. And this is what Mesorah is. It's something that holds us back, and guides us, and might even smack us, but it's for our own good, it's for the good of society, and it's the good of our children and future generations. And the other thing that most seirot do is they give us direction when sometimes we don't know what to do. How many times have my students come to me, and I'm sure that children and students and, you know, what does God want from me? What am I supposed to do here? From something as simple as, you know, how long is my sleeve, skirt, whatever supposed to be, to, you know, who do I marry? What school do I send my child to? What job do I take? You know, this job might give me a little bit more money, but is it going to, which obviously will allow me to, you know, give more tzedakah or pay more tuition or whatever. But on the other hand, this job might mean that I have to walk in the door in those 18 minutes. So what are my values? And what rules do is they guide us and they give us direction. So on the one hand, we want to do this. But on the other hand, we all know what happens when there are no rules. There's chaos and anarchy. And this is what Pirkei Avot is setting out at the very beginning, is that we have rules. These rules are for our benefit. And these rules are effectively what have maintained us and sustained us. And if we know what's good for us, we will value those rules qua rules, even if the rules might evolve and change, and even if the rules are interpreted differently. And just because you might not agree with a rule, just because you might not understand a rule, just because you think a rule might be stupid, doesn't mean that rules are bad. Right? Lord of the Flies, best example ever. Horrifying book. Really horrifying. Okay. So that's Mishnah 1. And again, these are tidbits. And what I'm hoping to share with you is a derech, is an approach, in that look at these words again carefully. Look at them, think about them, and if you have the privilege of understanding Hebrew, look at the word in Hebrew, look at the translation, question that translation, because every time you translate from one language to another, you're locking a word in. It always, you know, I've always said, like, one of these days I would love to read Rambam in the original Arabic, but that would require my learning Arabic, which I think I'm just too old at this point. Too many other things I need to learn, like how to use a smartphone. But that's much more imminent. Okay. Mishnah number two, which is the idea that there are multiple pillars on which a community stands, right? Al Torah, Al Ha'avodah, Al Gemilut Chasadim. And what happens, and I think what happens typically in society is that depending on the values of that society, the society narrows in on one thing, and that becomes the be-all and end-all. For example, in modern Western schools, whether they're secular or religious, what is the most important are basically two skill sets: a language skill set and a mathematical skill set. That's it. So if you're not really good with words, or you're not really good with numeric concepts, and you are in a Western system, you're going to have a really hard time. Now, if you're then in a Western Jewish system, you're really in trouble, because you have to be good at words and mathematical concepts and abstract thinking. All of this by the time you're 11, which anybody who knows Piaget will tell you is impossible with all but the most, you know, gifted. And I know we're all the top one percentile. Our children are all the top one percentile. Everybody is awesome. Great. That's not how it works, okay? So that what Howard Gardner presented already in the 1980s, I guess, and what project-based learning and passion-based learning and what we call 21st century skills is proposing is that unless we figure out ways to evaluate, meaning to put value on, things that are not just language-based or abstract thinking-based or math concept based, we're missing a lot of kids. And I think that this is what the Mishnah is saying. There are three things that you can excel in. One is Torah. Torah is learning. Torah is text. Torah is that area of linguistic skills, of abstract thinking skills. It's, you know, it's the Gemara student, it's the Chumash student, it's the English student, it's the history student, it's the calculus student, right? You can be good at any of those things. That's Torah, that's learning, that's cerebral. But then we tend to forget about the Avoda and the Gemilut Chasadim areas, right? So we have to think about what is Avoda. Avoda means service. Now, service can be done in any number of ways. Service can be done as service to the land, service to the community, army service, service in the sense of, you know, somebody who is incredibly organized and becomes a party planner or a building administrator and makes sure things can run. One of our tech people, he said to me, I was never good in school, but he just built a drone with a 3D printer that flies around the office. And I'm like, what? Like, I can't. So, and he's not afraid to use a soldering iron. These, you know, this is Avoda. These are the people, these are the engineers who build things. These are the kids who sit there for hours with Lego that we think are wasting their time. But then they can go out and look at a backyard and create a garden paradise. We call them gardeners. I call them brilliant. But our schooling doesn't, particularly not in areas like the Upper Midwest and the Northeast, because when I went to the one or the two people in my building who's really good gardener, and I just figured out, like, oh, wait, can we have a garden over there? And he said, no. And I said, why not? And he said, because in New Jersey, the prime growing season is July, August, and September, June, July, and August, which is really hard when you're not in school, as opposed to my colleagues in L.A. who can do gardens because it's June, July, and August there all year long. So that's the avoda piece of it. That's that person in the community who organizes meals, who goes visits in hospitals, who does all of. They're the doers. They're not necessarily the intellectuals. Or they're the daveners, or the Tehillim sayers, or the what Gardner calls the intrapersonal people. They're the ones who can work on themselves. And that's a very great skill set. And then there's the Gemilut Chasadim piece of it, which is people who are just simply kind. They're not there. The thing that motivates them is to do for others. It's not necessarily to build. It's not necessarily to learn. But it's to improve society, either one person at a time or one classroom at a time, and it's not necessarily for money. And these are the people whose minds, this is what Gardner calls interpersonal intelligence, and this is what we call 21st century soft skills. What does that mean, soft? It means that they're not, we can't grade them easily. But these are the people who, in a group of five, right, when tempers are starting to rise, and one person is like, my way or the highway, and the other one is like, ugh, when are we done here? It's that one person in the group of five who's like, okay, let's take a step back, let's see what's going on here. And we all know who that person is, and we take that for granted. But without that person, that group of five can't move, or that shul can't move, or that school, or that family, or that whatever it is, that office. That's the Gemilut Chasadim, and already from the very, very, very beginning, the second Mishnah of Pirkei Avot says, you need different ways of approaching the same goal of maintaining a religion and maintaining a society and maintaining it for 3,000 years. There's not only one right answer. There's at least three major highways, and then forget about all the exit ramps, which... Again, it sounds counterintuitive in this world that we live in that has in many ways become more polarized and more bifurcated and more isolated. That, you know, the idea like, okay, maybe your way is just as right as my way, which I think is an incredibly important lesson to learn in a family, in a relationship, in a classroom, in just being human. Okay, moving on. Mishnah number three. Mishnah number three is really interesting to me for two reasons. And reason number two is for what the Mishnah actually says. But reason number one is for who says it. So I am a history nerd. I'm a nerd, period, just with a capital M-N, a nerd. I'm really blessed. I work with an entire department full of nerds. It's you know, right? We're nerds and we're proud. Like, we like meetings because we get a chance to talk more Torah. Our emails go back and forth about, is it better to teach the kids how to use the Bar Ilan, or is it better to teach them how to use an actual paper hardback concordance? And these emails can go back and forth for weeks. Like, that's how nerdy we really are. Okay? So the name Antigonus, right, Antigonus Ish Soho, that name right away sparked something in me, like, wait, that's not a Jewish name, right? Antigonus is a Greek name. And so I go to my handy-dandy source of pretty much all things, Rav Google, and I look up Antigonus, who takes me to the Uber Gemara of all things, Wikipedia. There he is, Antigonus. And when I learn from the Holy Wikipedia, and all joking aside, I happen to think this is another skill that students, we think, I don't know, Lynn, how your experience, we assume that because millennials are what they're called digital natives, that they all know how to use the digital, that is wrong. They need to learn how to do a Google search. They need to learn how to read a Wikipedia article. Like, we had to learn how to open up the encyclopedia, and we had to know the alphabet. By the way, they do have to know how to spell, because as you and I both know really well, Google is very persnickety, and if you don't spell it right, you're not going to find it. Right? So even though English is the stupidest spelling language on the planet, except maybe for Finnish, and I have that from my father, Alav HaShalom, who helped work on the original dictionaries for computers, they still do have to learn how to spell. And believe it or not, text writing and writing are two different writings at this point. Like, American Sign Language is a different language. Text language is a different language. Don't despair. They really do still know how to learn, need to learn how to spell. It's self-preservation. So Antigonus was considered the father of the Pharisees. And the Pharisees are the ones that we call the Prushim, right? The ones that separated themselves. And the Pharisees are the ones that were the forebearers of what we consider, you know, rabbinic Judaism, the Tanaim. Now, they weren't the only game in town, much like Orthodoxy is not the only game in town. There was never one game in town. There was always at least two. At the very least, there were those who served God only, and then there were those that served God, but also had, you know, the little idols, or served God and the local deity, because, you know, hey, you want to hedge your bets, right? So there were always at least two options. By this point in time, there were many more than two. And Antigonus was presenting the Pharisee option, which is why he said, don't serve God in order to receive a reward. Serve God in order to serve God. Meaning, don't do things in this world for the sole purpose of this ephemeral concept of the world to come. Now, this sounds bizarre to us because the concept of Olam Haba, certainly since the time of the Rambam, is one of our pillars of faith. So for somebody from the Mishnah that says, okay, could we like forget about Olam Haba here and just focus on Olam Hazeh, sounds radical. And it was radical. It was so radical that his student, Tzadok, became the founder of the Sadducees. And his other student, Baitus, became the head of the Baitusim, which was similar to the Sadducees. And the Tzedukim and the Baitusim are often referred to in the Mishnah as like the villains of misunderstanding halacha, which they were. You can't only focus on Olam Hazeh, right? If you don't assume that there is an Olam Haba, number one, then we absolutely have no way of dealing with Tzadik Viralo. But on the other hand, we have no accountability. The existentialists tried to do that in the 1950s, and they gave up because it just didn't work. You can't just focus on this world. There has to be accountability to the next world. On the other hand, if, like the Essenes, you only focus on the next world, and the Essenes are what gave birth to Christianity, and you have to remember that the founders of Christianity were Jews, they were Tanaitic Jews, and some of them were Tanaim themselves, who, as we say in modern parlance, went off the derech, or went on a different derech. Right? A different shiur, which is you know, contextualizing Tanaitic writing and Midrash and Mishnah. But the idea is, like, you can't just go to Olam Haba. You can't just go to Olam Hazeh. You have to find this balance. And balance is the golden word in Judaism. The balance between the individual and the community, the self and the other, the teacher and the student, God and the human. But can you imagine if someone like Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal, or Rav Moshe Zatzal, or any one of our great local modern poskim. Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Rabbi Teller, you know, I don't even remember who they all are, but pick your yeshiva, Skokie, Tells, you know, whoever your Rebbe is, you know, whether it's Aguda, whether it's Torah Mitzion, Kolel Torah Mitzion, whether it's YU, whether it's not, whether it's Chovevei Torah, whether it's Gush, whether it's KBY, whatever. Choose your guy in your mind. And now imagine that this teacher's top two students, right? Like Lahavdil, Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital, Lahavdil, Rav Schechter and Rav Willig, would start sects of religion that were completely anathema to our belief system. Would anybody remember the Rav? No. They'd be like, ugh, clearly he was not an effective educator because look at what happened to his students. They went off the derech. They messed up. And they messed up big. They messed up colossally. They messed up to the tune of negating fundamental beliefs in Judaism. Oh, peachy keen. And yet he's quoted in the Mishnah, and he's the third one. So what I believe that this Mishnah is teaching us is that look at what somebody as an individual has to contribute. Look at who an individual is. Like the previous Mishnah says, okay, there are different ways of going about things. But this Mishnah is saying, no, what Antigonus taught, he taught with a whole heart, and he taught honestly, and he taught with commitment. And the fact that his Talmidim went off the deep end cannot be pinned totally at his feet. And yet, on the other hand, it goes directly to Mishnah Yud Aleph, which is, to me, one of the most terrifying and humbling Mishnayot as an educator, which is basically like, as an educator, and we are all educators, okay? Make no mistake, every single human being on the planet is an educator in some form or another, even if you are not a formal educator, because to educate means to model behavior. So you're modeling it for your children or for your friends or for your colleagues or for your community members or, you know, and you can learn from those same people. And Lord knows in this election season we see what bad modeling is, regardless of which side of the aisle is, right? We really see what happens when there's a loss of respect and a loss of humility and a loss of integrity and a loss of a sense of why are we all here and why is this country so special as a child of Holocaust survivors. So what the Mishnah, I believe, is saying is like, if someone has something wise to teach you, learn from that person. And learn and respect where that person is coming from, because the result of not teaching and the result of poor teaching is exile, is galus, right? Or death. There's another Mishnah later on that basically says that if somebody has something to teach and doesn't, they're chayav mita. They're liable for death. Now, that doesn't mean if they have something to teach and they don't teach it because they can't. It means if they have something to teach and they refuse to do it because they're so arrogant or they're so, you know, wrapped up in I don't have the kind of time of day for you. That's the attitude that the Mishnah is talking about. I don't want you to, you know, think that anybody who's not a teacher is damned. That's not what the Mishnah is saying. But to close, to me, what Pirkei Avot does, and the language in which it is written, and this is the season of Pirkei Avot, right? It's Pesach to Rosh Hashanah, is that if you take a step and you look at every word, every idea, and some of them are much more relevant to education and psychology, and some of them don't, and some of them are bothersome, because they are written by human beings, and some of those human beings had attitudes that we don't particularly like or agree with. like Rabbi Yossi HaGlili, who said, Al tarba sicha im ha'isha, do not have a lot of conversation with a woman, your own wife, kal v'chomer, somebody else's wife, right? So, oh, he was a misogynist, da-da-da, which he probably was. That doesn't mean that his Torah isn't valuable. That doesn't mean that we can't learn from it. And that you look at these words and you think about these catchphrases like passion-based learning or problem, you know, project-based learning or soft skills or interpersonal communication skills or nurturing or attachment or Piaget or Freud or Gardner. And, you know, you pick your model. But the amazing thing is it's all in there because the Chachamim had a living sense, I believe, of what it means to walk the talk. And that if you are constantly mindful, and if you are constantly knowing that you are responsible to the other, and by that, then the other is mindful that he or she is responsible to you, and that you're carrying something on your shoulders that has come down from way back, all the way back to Hashem and Har Sinai, and that what you're carrying somehow has to last another 3,000 years, right? That changes your whole approach to teaching, to learning, to internalizing, and to acting. And in that way, it really can, the Torah becomes this wellspring, Maya note, open pitch here. But the, another quote from Pirkei Avot, which is probably one of my all-time mantras, which is hafochba, hafochba, decholaba, that everything, if you keep turning it over and turning it over, and it doesn't matter if you're 20 or if you're 50 or if you're 90, but the more you keep digging in that and going back to it and going back to it, the more you're going to learn and you're going to see things because you grow and you have more experiences. You're going to see things that you didn't see before just because you're a different person. And to me, that's the most extraordinary thing of Torah of all, is that it changes with me or with you, and it changes with us, and it is always something that is greater than the sum of its parts. So, happy Mother's Day, everybody, and thank you for coming. Okay, only 5 minutes over.
Did you start 5 minutes over? Okay.